This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. And in this part of the show, we will be looking for your questions on prescription drugs. This is something that we have done on and off over the years, and we're very happy to have back with us as our guest, Dr. Jim Rybacki. He is a pharmacist. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. He is author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. This was something that existed for many years as a paper book and more recently has gone electronic. In fact, the most recent incarnation, which is called The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 12 Top Meds for 2012, is out. It does exist as a paper book. You can also have it as a Kindle if you want to have it that way. He's the editor of the website, EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com, which has a lot of information on prescription medicines and questions related to their use, concentrating on particular things. So if you're interested in issues like heart disease or osteoporosis or diabetes, there is specific information for those things. And he is with us every once in a while to talk about things that are new that have to do with prescription drugs. But we can also be a resource for you on these programs. That's really why we're doing them. So if you have questions about medicines that you are taking, call us and you can talk with him about it. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also write, if you like. You can send us an email, and the address there is willtalk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you'd like to join us, please do pick up the telephone and give us a call. And Dr. Jim, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I am just having an adventure of a day, and now I get to talk to you and the delightful callers who seem to call in from everywhere in the universe.
All right. Well, good. Well, we'll see how we can. Well, I don't know about the universe. We'll see what we can do. And, of course, there are a number of things that we can talk about. And actually, I was going to pick one that's sort of been on my mind in some of our past conversations, and I'm not sure we've really gotten around to. But that is, it's this. And I think in the past, if people talked about the drug problem, quote-unquote, in America, they were talking about illegal drugs. But it seems that we are now becoming increasingly aware that people are misusing prescription medications. And in some cases, maybe people are doing this recreationally, but I think in a lot of cases, what people are doing is they're looking for a therapeutic effect. And what they're doing, essentially, they're prescribing for themselves or they're treating themselves, which can be potentially really dangerous if you mix things together. So how are people in your line of work, people who are in the business of writing about medicines and dispensing medicines, thinking about this?
It's a tremendous and complicated issue, and sometimes, for example, friends of friends will say, well, your symptoms sound just like mine, David. Let me give you some of the Rybackium that I have, and that'll probably help you. Mm-hmm. And the answer in that becomes, that's potentially a prescription for disaster. First of all, most of us are not really trained, although we may think we are because we can get a lot of information from the web now, to look at things and sort of make what is called a differential diagnosis. And that's something, again, your symptoms sound just like mine. I think you ought to go talk to your doctor about this. That would be a good way to do it, not let me open up my pill bottle and take a look at that. It's really challenging in a number of senses where you look at actually information that goes to physicians and information that goes to clinical pharmacists and nurse practitioners. And there was a study recently, Quest Diagnostics, took a look at lab tests and interesting design. I haven't heard of anything like this before, but actually took a look at about 76,000 specimens, and they basically de-identified them, meaning if Jim Rybacki's name was on it and any other identification was there, it was removed, and then actually tested the specimens to see what was in it. And the amazing thing was that there was a lot of variance between what was prescribed and what was actually there in the specimens. You know, that says, geez, some things are going on with different kinds of medicines, and there were inconsistencies in different drug classes, from everything from central nervous system depressants and amphetamines to oxycodones, but there were also prescription drugs that were not part of the patient's profile. So that's something, you know, in general, please don't share your medicines with other patients, family members, or friends. And if you look at it, that's just a risk. It actually technically, particularly in the sense of scheduled medications, it's illegal. You just don't want to start doing that and start down that road. The other piece of that, and I'm really an advocate for appropriate adherence, compliance, and targets. And one of the things I talk about in all of the profiles in the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs is understanding what the goals are for any medicine, understanding how long you need to take it to see, in general, the peak effect, and then certainly understanding any potential side effects. And if you're just getting a particular medicine because the symptoms are sort of like Uncle Bob's from Uncle Bob, that loses all the follow-up and understanding. And again, it's something I'm amazed people do it. You know, it potentially comes from that, well, you know, I was just trying to help. Mm-hmm. But in reality, you're almost creating and ensuring an episodic non-adherence for a particular medicine, which in general doesn't get you the best outcomes and almost guarantees that you're going to have some potential issues with the medicine being stopped, whatever those may be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to keep in mind. Certainly don't pass around your pills and don't take somebody else's. Well, I have a couple of people who are ready to go here with questions.
Okay.
So let's do that. And we will start with someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello. I think that's me.
Yes.
I was wondering about aspirin, because I've been reading some health newsletters that they're concerned about people being prescribed aspirin, and that it often leads to bleeding. And I have stents in my leg, and I was wondering if I was one of the people that I do take it, but
okay. So the first question is, when you look at stents, was that what I heard, stents?
Yes.
In your leg? Yeah, okay. And so for our listeners, basically a stent is sort of an advocate for better plumbing in a blood vessel. A lot of people get stents after a heart attack. Sometimes with PVD or peripheral vascular disease, there are stents put in. And at times when there are either congenital things that you're born with, presentations that are insufficiencies in circulation, basically sort of like a water main going to your house and not enough water getting there, to be in a direct analogy, there's these little metal and sometimes drug-releasing stents put in to keep that particular blood vessel open. And in the case of coronary arteries, can be a real lifesaver. So after that, what you basically have is some new plumbing in a house that's however old you are. And one of the ideas and one of the important things as a benefit-to-risk decision is to look at preventing possible blood clots. Now, did your doctor or whoever prescribed the aspirin say this is what we're doing and how long we're going to? Is it a lower-dose aspirin?
Yes.
And so typically that's an 81. Is that what you're taking?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yep. And so do you take an enteric-coated one?
Oh.
Or do you know?
Off and on sometimes.
Okay. So
you usually.
So in the particular kinds that are available, so if you look at what happens with brand names, the one I happen to take is Ecotren, and that is one of those enteric-coated ones. What that does is protects the lining a little bit by the way it actually dissolves. And so looking at someone with and in general, the sort of guidelines for this, in the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, I have about 18 pages on aspirin alone, because I think that it would be a prescription drug if it actually came before the FDA this time. But looking at people with existing disease and with known cardiac disease and after a heart attack and at certain age points, the benefits of that particular aspirin in sort of making platelets are the elements in the blood that help you make a blood clot. And that's a good thing if you cut yourself. A great thing if I cut myself shaving like I did this morning. And when you look at that, that's a bad thing to actually happen in one of the vessels in your leg. When that does happen, that's usually a DVT or a blood clot there. If it's in the heart, it's a heart attack. If it's in a blood vessel supplying the brain, then that's actually what a stroke happens from, is that particular undesirable blood clot. So the aspirin makes the platelets a little bit more slippery, and in general, it makes you less likely to have a clot. Now, some of the things to look for with aspirin itself, and you're right about that, it can cause some bleeding. Is it rare? Well, it depends on who the people are who are taking the aspirin. And so if you had a history of an ulcer, for example, stomach or intestinal or duodenal one, then that sort of changes the picture and the outlook a little bit. And the question then becomes, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And so that's the kind of decision that your doctor has to make. And if you were to see, for example, black stools or reddish tinge in urine, those sorts of things, then that's something you should talk to your doctor about, because that can obviously be that sign of bleeding. There's an interesting combination and some approaches that have been taken looking at, there's actually a fixed-dose combination. This is in the case of ibuprofen, but it's actually been combined with famotidine, which is an H2 blocker, and it actually has that thought of, well, maybe we can try to prevent some of these problems if they happen. But in general, when you have that real set of risk factors, those benefits of that small aspirin dose can outweigh those risks.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And again, I guess we want to underline that for those people who have heard that taking a low-dose aspirin every day may indeed lower your risk of heart attack. It is not completely without negative side effects, so that's not something you should just do. People should to talk about that with your doctor, and if the doctor says okay, then okay.
Exactly. Actually, there's a good website, millionhearts.hhs.gov, and that actually talks about the ABCs of cardiology, and the first A in that is appropriate use of aspirin, and they actually define on that sort of where that sort of benefit versus risk leans more on the side of benefits. And again, you're exactly right. Just because you can get it without a prescription doesn't mean you need to start taking it, and there is that possibility of ulceration or some bleeding, and that's something you need to talk to your doctor about first.
All right. We have some other callers here. Just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Dr. James Rybacki. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. He is author of the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and in its newest incarnation, it's the Essential Guide Top 12 Meds for 2012.
Yes, it is.
It's available in paper and also as an ebook. He also is the editor of a website that has a lot of information on health and prescription drugs, and that's the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs.com. So if you smush all that together without any spaces in between, you can find it. Or I think if you just put Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs into your web browser, you'll get there.
You'll find me.
Questions are welcome, and we have some other folks here. And next, we'll talk with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been on Paxil or paroxetine for over 10 years, and I was just wondering what potential side effects there might be to that drug.
So when you look at that, is this the Paxil CR, or is it the immediate release form?
The immediate release.
Okay. And so when you look at that, the whole class of medicines looking at the sort of Paxils of the world, that's a very widely prescribed one. But, excuse me, that's actually a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And when you pull out the information in general on this whole family of medicines, that includes the Celexas of the world as well, the benefit and risk there is really much towards the benefits. Now, you said you've been taking it for 10 years, which says to me over that time, usually what happens is whoever prescribed this would look at, for example, if it's being used for depression, they'd look at a Hamilton depression scale or one of those kinds of inventories to actually take a look and see how your depression is or was when you started, or if it's for panic attacks, how the particular triggers for panic are modified, and once you introduce the medicine then to see how they change. Having said all of that, and the fact that you're taking it for 10 years, that's one of those medicines that, in general, when you look at it over time, there is a couple things just to think about. The first is, have you worked with the prescriber to get the goals of the medicine, and do you understand them, and have you reached them? If not, in general, what you do is you change the medication dose, and it's called titration, to get the most effect versus any kind of side effects. And the other question is, if you look at this, if you ever would have to stop a medicine in this family, one of the things that's very important to do is to actually titrate it downward. So this in general, and any of the medicines in that family, should not be abruptly stopped, because there can be a withdrawal syndrome. That doesn't mean it's a bad drug or a bad medicine. It just means that it's one of those things your body sort of gets used to. And if you would need to stop it, you just need to slowly decrease it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Well, and we'll go on to another caller coming back here to Champaign, line number 2. Hello. Is there a caller there in Champaign?
Hello?
Line 2? Yes, go ahead.
One.
Oh, no, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. I might have a question.
Yes.
One of them is, if you've got Barrett's syndrome, is there any form of aspirin that you could take on it once in a while?
Hey, wait a minute. So you have Barrett's esophagitis?
Yeah.
Okay. And so when you look at that, did you talk to you probably saw a gastroenterologist. And did you talk to your doctor about that? And what's the reason for taking the aspirin?
Oh, I have a little eye headache. It's over my eye on the left side, and sometimes I take it for that, or I take something for that. I've been taking Tylenol.
I was just going to say, if you look at that. So the first question is, if something that is not a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drug, not in that family of medicines, would work. And the thing I would definitely go to is esophagitis. And thinking about the esophagitis with a nonsteroidal drug, I'd say, well, has Tylenol worked for you? And if that's the case, why don't we go ahead with that?
Mm-hmm.
So has that worked or not?
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm.
And so what you're concerned about?
I was trying to think of times where I think the aspirin would have worked better, and I think that's on nerve pain, right?
Well, and so when you look at it in the sense of aspirin or Aleve or naproxen or
ibuprofen, is that
or ibuprofen? Yeah, that's Motrin. And so when you look at that, what you already have, and for our listeners, she already has a sort of a change in some of the cells in the esophagus, and mm-hmm. so this is something that your mm-hmm. doctor is going to be taking a look at. And you?
Oh yeah, I just had an endoscopy this morning.
Okay, so they actually took a look at. Oh my gosh! And,
yeah.
And so taking a look at that—that's actually where you're putting an instrument to take a look down there. What happens with Barrett's esophagitis? There's some changes in the cells, and mm-hmm. sometimes there's also a history of what's called reflux esophagitis, meaning some of the acids coming back up. So usually they would give you a proton pump inhibitor, something like that. Are you taking mm-hmm. one of the metprazole kind of medicines?
Yeah.
And so
Prilosec.
Yep, okay. And so looking at that, one of the things in people with this particular condition is to make sure that you don't put anything else in there in general that is going to irritate that particular irritated area as well.
Okay.
So if the Tylenol works, that's certainly a fine thing. The other thing to be aware of, though, mm-hmm. is talk to your doctor about that in the sense of a selective COX-2 inhibitor, something like Celebrex, if you don't have any contraindications to that, can be a little bit more selective and a little bit easier on your stomach and that particular lining. In the sense of the esophagus itself, if it's coated and you take it with half a glass of water first and another half, and then you have to talk to your doctor about that. But that may be a way to avoid any irritation on the way down.
Okay.
And the last thing I would say is that looking at the medicines in that family itself, mm-hmm. in the proton pump inhibitors, one of the things that has come out and you want to talk to your doctor about mm-hmm. is looking at your bones, if you've been taking this medicine for a long time, in general about a year, it actually can look at some changes in the thickness of your bone.
I was wondering. Okay, that's interesting. I need to know that because we don't take those other substitutes for calcium because of the jawbone problem.
Well, and that's what you're referring to, and for our listeners, that's why this is a complicated one, but that's actually something called osteonecrosis, which is a potential risk. And so looking at that, the idea came up, having some yogurt and things like that, food sources, broccoli, that are high in calcium.
I have one more question.
Yes, ma'am.
And that is, because I'm on amitriptyline, imipramine.
Okay, so that's a cyclic antidepressant.
I know that this is going to irritate my esophagus. Most of them do. Well, it doesn't irritate necessarily, but it slows down my motility, which I have trouble with. And they've come out with, I think it's transcranial stimulation, where they put something on the back of your head to get rid of depression. And I wish I knew more about that, because when I talked to my doctor, he said, oh, you're not a candidate for that, but I refuse to give up, and I'm watching because it's nicer not to be on meds.
Well, and I understand that, and many people would prefer not to.
Especially if you've got slow motility.
Would prefer not to as well. And so the two questions are to go back to your doctor and say, well, gee, what would you think about something to actually potentially increase motility? It sounds like you're maybe having a little bit of a problem, sometimes with constipation, sometimes with a little feeling of fullness. And that's something, again, you would need to talk to your doctor about. But the way to look at the transcranial approach that you're talking about would be to actually go to clinicaltrials.gov and then put in that particular search term, and anybody can actually do that. It's not for professionals, but that will tell you studies that are going on now that they actually give a look, and you might meet the entrance criteria. All righty?
All right, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you for the call. Well, again, other questions are certainly welcome. We're talking in this hour of focus with Dr. James Rybacki. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute, author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and editor of the website essentialguideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. So if you have questions, you can give us a call. I think that this is something, problem with potential bone loss as a result of long-term use of proton pump inhibitors, we're starting to hear more about, and certainly I would expect this should be a particular concern for postmenopausal women. Has it been as big an issue in men as well?
That's a very interesting, you're a smart man. See, the interesting point in that is, who do these things become an issue in? So can the medicine cause a change? Our bones undergo bone remodeling. There's a bone remodeling cycle. And so it's basically sort of like a brick wall, and one of the bricks becomes a little bit cracked, and these cells come in and take out that particular broken brick, and then different cells come in and fix the wall, and all of a sudden you have a healthy bone again. If you don't have the calcium to do that, and if you have some changes in either the osteoblasts that make bone or osteoclasts that remove it, and they're working too fast, then you can actually get thinner bones, which is called osteopenia. And the difference in this, men certainly can get osteoporosis. If you go to www.nof.org, that's the National Osteoporosis Foundation, there's some really good information there about osteoporosis in men. And typically what you can see, there are some, I hate to use a complicated term, there's some vitamin D receptor alleles, and depending on the genetics there, you may or may not be able to work with your vitamin D, even though you're getting an adequate amount, and you may not get enough calcium into your system, and there the benefits of a supplement sort of make some sense. So there's not a specific test for that yet, although your doctor can get a vitamin D level. The important thing is, though, where are your bones right now? If I look at a 6'2" ex-football player who happens to be 60 years old or so now, and that person has a pretty good diet, is still exercising, weight-bearing exercise actually stimulates something called mechanoreceptors, and what that means is that it sort of sends a signal, hey, let's keep our bones healthy and let's keep this active. If, on the other hand, you have the same age person who was a very thin person and has always been thin all of their life, didn't really reach a peak bone mass or the strongest, biggest bones you could have, maybe like Arnold could be, and I know that was a bad accent, but if you think about it, you didn't pump me up. And so basically, thin people then who get put on a medicine like a proton pump inhibitor, and it, this only happens sort of after a year or so where that becomes a risk. There can be magnesium loss earlier, and there can be a C. difficile-associated diarrhea. So if you start having a diarrhea that continues while you're taking a proton pump inhibitor, you need to call your doctor about that. But risk comes from thin bones. And, you know, thin females are more at risk than really heavy-boned females in general. And so if you start a medicine like that, the risk is greater in that skinny person. I'm sorry, all the skinny people out there, you have to listen, but you can get a bone mineral density test or a DEXA every 2 years to take a look at that. And you're exactly right, especially around menopause, perimenopausal women. And when you look at that sort of in general in the 50s where menopause tends to happen, that's a point where you can have some rapid bone loss. And you need to talk to your doctor ahead of time, especially if you have that family history.
Okay. We have some other callers here. We'll talk with some more folks in just a moment. And our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He is editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. And we'll take some more calls after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Fresh Air's debut as a daily NPR program. We'll listen back to highlights of Fresh Air concerts, including performances by Richard Thompson, John Doe, Shirley Horn, Nick Lowe, and Susanna McCorkle. And we'll have a little Name That Voice guessing game. Happy anniversary to us on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here Monday through Friday from 10 until noon. 10 different topics across the week. On the program on Monday, our guest is Ben Locke from Penn State University, where he's the director of counseling services there, or associate director of counseling services. And we'll talk about the issue of mental health on college campuses, something that's becoming more and more of a problem for administrators on colleges as greater and greater numbers of students come with pre-existing conditions. We'll talk about how universities are trying to deal with that Monday at 10. In the second hour, the guest is Dario Mastropieri. He's a primatologist at University of Chicago. We'll talk about his book, Games Primates Play, which takes a look at human social relationships and the way that they mirror those of our closest animal relatives. And I'll tell you one more in the way of a how-to next week on Tuesday. Rick Karch will be here. He's an auto mechanic. His business is Rick's Automotive. And if you're having car trouble, you can give us a call. And you can check the schedule for the rest of the week by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs there. And the guest for this hour of Focus is Dr. Jim Rybacki. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. He's author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and the new version is The Essential Guide, 12 Top Meds for 2012. It's available in paper or as an ebook. He also has a website, has a lot of good information on it, and that is The Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. If you have questions, we have certainly time for you. We'll try to take as many people as we can. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you'd like, which is will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go back to the phones here, and our next caller is in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I've been prescribed Suboxone and Klonopin for the past 2 years, and I'm a 22-year-old. I'm not in college right now, but I happen, and I was just wondering what the long-term side effects of Suboxone are, because right now it seems to be working really well for what it's prescribed for, which is opioid dependence and I was just seeing if there's any long-term dangerous side effects that go along with it.
And so, what was the drug?
Suboxone.
Oh, Suboxone. For our listeners, Suboxone. And so, yeah. So, looking at that, the question with this is, when you have a problem with opioid dependence, what can you do about that? And the Suboxone is, and I pardon, the connection was just a little sketchy there.
Okay.
So Suboxone is actually a combination are you taking, you're taking the sublingual?
Yeah, I'm taking
the
sublingual strip.
And so that's actually naloxone combined with buprenorphine.
Mm-hmm.
And the what happens with this is that the combination of the drugs is actually a long-term indication for opioid dependence. And are you in a treatment plan as well?
I go to a place once every 2 weeks.
Yep, good for you. And so there's follow-up there. One of the things and one of the challenges, and we know the FDA actually has an opioid initiative now to look at prescription medicines, and in particular the medicines that are like morphine that people can become dependent on. And so getting that combination of help in the sense of counseling plus a pill, have they talked to you about skills that can help you make changes and stay in treatment and those sorts of things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You go over that and stuff.
Yeah, that's actually very, very important. And so when you look at that, you want to keep this away from kids and those sorts of things. Suboxone can actually... in children can cause some breathing problems, and that's something you need to be careful of. And I think the other issues looking at that, there's sort of an induction phase. So in the first sort of 2 to 3 weeks, the possibility there. How long have you been taking this?
About two and a half years.
Oh, okay, so in that sense, one of the things that can happen with these kind of medicines is that in the first 2 to 3 days or so, certainly not years, you can have a moderate sort of state of withdrawal because the receptors in your brain then sort of, they've gotten used to having these medicines around, and it becomes then, that's a challenge for the brain cells themselves, and so they have a little bit of a reaction to that. And I think the combination in general usually is pretty well tolerated. Some nausea and vomiting, sweating, constipation. Have you had any trouble sleeping or anything?
No, it actually helps me sleep usually.
That's actually a more common effect, and that also might be the Klonopin as well. And so I guess probably... the only other thing I would include for more frequent things would be swelling in the feet or legs, and, you know, those generally are things you should talk to your doctor about. But if you haven't had those in this length of time, it sounds like this is being a home run for you, and it's actually helping the challenges you've been dealing with, and congratulations. That's a tough road to hoe, and it sounds like you're in the middle of it, and you're doing it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But... I guess that answers my question.
Okay. Well, good. Great. Hope that helps. Very good. We'll then go on to another person, and this next person is in Sullivan, line number 4. Hello. Okay, we have maybe got a problem with that line. And something was wrong with that. If that person wants to try to call back, I guess we can try it again. Otherwise, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
Could I mention just something briefly, David?
Yes.
David,
yes.
One of the things that I think is very, very important in general with medicines that are like morphine used for chronic pain, or medicines like fentanyl that we've probably most of us have heard of in a patch form, those can be tremendous, tremendous benefits in chronic pain or pain after an accident, those sorts of things. Unfortunately, they do carry a dependence and an addiction potential, and if there's a feeling that there's a want, a need, a sort of drug-seeking kind of feeling that's developing, that's something you need to talk to your doctor about pretty quickly. And it's something that, again, the medicines can be tapered off, changed to other non-opioid medicines. But, again, if there's a problem, medicines like Suboxone, the older one was actually Naloxone itself, and so that combination and putting those to work over time combined with counseling, I think is a tremendous act of bravery, and it's something then that over time your brain is going to be less used to, and in the sense that less expecting, I guess is a reasonable way to say it, that opioid med to be on board, and that can have a very successful outcome.
Okay. We're going to try that last caller again, on Sullivan. Okay. We'll see if we can get it this time. On line four, hello.
Yeah. Oh, a couple years ago, I was, shall we say, had a sedentary situation, and prior to that, I did not have any trouble urinating, and then they put me on Rapaflow. What's the problems with that that it can cause at a later date? It wasn't, and now they're on a generic Rapaflow.
Did you hear that okay, Jim?
Well, not really.
Person was talking about problems, potential problems associated with a drug called Rapaflow.
Okay, but he was. I thought he said he was sedentary.
Yes, for 30 days.
Oh, okay, okay. So, Rapaflow. This is a somewhat sensitive question, but if you're comfortable talking about that on the radio, so.
Don't follow me.
Okay, so in general, Rapaflow is a medicine, a felodosin that actually helps benign prostatic hypertrophy. And so when you look at that, what that basically is a situation that I'm sort of in that range where as you get a little bit older, sometimes the prostate actually grows or hypertrophies, and that can actually impact the ability to urinate, and so it becomes somewhat more challenging to go to the bathroom, and usually just being sedentary or sitting around, that won't cause the hyperplasia, but it may be incidental in the sense of you maybe notice it more. So you're taking a generic one now, and I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yes, I'm taking generic now.
Right.
The insurance would not pay. But I was just curious what would be the physical consequence of taking, the generic form of Rapaflow,
Oh, okay. Yep. And so looking at that, this is a question. It's interesting. There's about 4 billion with a B, prescriptions in the U.S. now. It's actually 3.99. Otherwise, I know somebody will call in and say, hey, you got that one wrong, Rybacki. But anyway, lots of prescriptions in the U.S. So about 3.99 billion, and probably depends on who you read, but between $320 or $340 billion spent on them. And interestingly, about 75% of those prescriptions are now for generic medicines. And the controversy around generics and people's frank distrust of them comes from probably what now is about 15 or 16 years ago, and just a couple manufacturers where there were some questions from the FDA of good manufacturing practices and or GMPs, as they're known, and those were really cramped and clamped down on. And so the regulations, the pharmacovigilance, the bioequivalence, meaning the one medicine gets into your body, if you look at the curves of how they reach peak levels, they get into the body in the same way, reach the same general peaks, and have the same general lower amounts in between doses. So I would take a generic in a heartbeat.
Okay, and a physical consequence later on?
In the
sense, my BPH is so high.
I'm sorry, one more time?
My BPH is high.
In your BPH? In the sense,
yeah.
That particular medicine is in a family called alpha blockers, and what that means is it actually kind of helps relax the muscles in the prostate and the bladder neck. So looking at that, some side effect issues, they're usually pretty mild, some dizziness or headache, that kind of stuff. If there's a feeling like, and that would usually happen pretty soon after you start taking the medicine, generic or brand, But if there's severe dizziness or feeling like you would pass out, those are things that you'd need to talk to your doctor about. There can be a rare effects on the liver, so if you had a change or a yellowing in the skin or the eyes, jaundice, something like that, that's something you would need to talk to your doctor about. And there's actually a very rare side effect that can happen. It's actually an erection that's usually painful and lasts for 4 hours or longer. But, again, that's one of those very rare things that could happen. It doesn't sound like you've had anything like that.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, we have maybe about 10 minutes left here with Dr. Jim Rabecki. If you have questions about prescription medicine, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, there are a couple of things that have been in the news here lately that I thought maybe we might talk about.
Okay.
Certainly one of the things we know is, in this country, weight is a serious public health issue.
Oh,
and that we have a lot of people that are not just a little bit over their healthy body weight, they're a lot over. And there are people who are at the point where diet and exercise will be helpful, but maybe not helpful enough. And so there are medications that are available to help with people who are extremely overweight. And in fact, just now the FDA has approved the first new diet pill in more than 10 years. I think that's just happened like within the last day or something.
yes,
and maybe you can, I don't know if you're talking about that specific medicine, but maybe you might want to talk a little bit generally about prescription drugs that are created to try to help people who really need to lose weight.
Sure. So looking at that, the biggest challenge in this, and you know, since we had our two children, you know, I've certainly wrestled with the 10 or 15 pounds that I gained there. Of course, I'm joking. But, you know, as we get older, it becomes more difficult to control weight, take off weight. And in general, the efforts become pretty challenging with diet alone. Of course, diets are notoriously difficult to stick to. And so the groups of medicines are in general stimulants, which are sort of the phentermines, and you know we've all heard of fen-phen in the past, which had some heart valve problems. But ephedrine, epidra is still available. And then looking at the newer medicines, the interesting point, and the one you're actually talking about, I actually put a blurb up. First, I put a blurb up saying I wasn't really sure, actually, on my blog, that the FDA was going to move forward with this particular medicine, but it's called lorcaserin, and Lorcas is the brand name. And it's interesting because I was actually at the FDA hearing where the FDA actually asked for some more data on this particular medicine. And this actually works on 5-hydroxytryptamine, and I won't bother with the receptor subtype, but what it means is that serotonin in general can have some benefits on feeling full and not feeling as hungry as you might. And the benefit here and the goal the FDA sort of said as well, you know, let's look at what percent of patients lose some weight. And so about 40%, I think 38 or so percent of people in the study here lost about 5% of their weight in a year. And so the support of this was actually a recommendation from an advisory committee, and the votes were about 18 to 4, I believe. And you're correct about this, David. It's a first new weight loss drug, and interesting in the sense of the way that it works. And there's also another one called Qnexa, which is a combination of phentermine and topiramate, so actually a stimulant drug, and an older seizure medicine, and that's been deferred, I think, until July for that committee meeting for the FDA to see what happens. But no question, increased weight increases blood pressure, puts you at risk for diabetes, and I think it's interesting that it looks like once the pipeline is filled, probably have another new medicine to stop fat attacks, and gosh, we need to do that.
Okay. Well, we got some other callers here. We'll try to get one or two, at least get as many as we can. We'll go first to Champagne and line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about the whole idea of Fosamax and the biphosphonates. I took it for a while and developed reflux.
Uh-huh.
And then switched to Evista. And while I had osteopenia, and I still have osteopenia, I've had bone density scans, and I thought the Evista worked actually quite well with no side effects that I could ever see, and I was on it for a large number of years. And then my doctor wanted me to switch to Atelvia because this is supposed to not cause acid reflux. And I'm having a fight with myself. I kind of wonder why I'm giving up Evista because I think it served me well. So I'm wondering what you think of Atelvia.
Okay. And so looking at this, boy, that's a wonderfully complicated question. The short answer is, Fosamax or alendronate belongs to the family of medicines called bisphosphonates, and you're exactly right about that. The interesting part is that you said you transitioned to raloxifene. And looking at that, that's actually a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. So it sort of works in has a little bit different mechanism of action, but has the impact, obviously, of maintaining the sort of bone density that you have. And it sounds like even though you're still osteopenic, you've not lost. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's what I believe at this point. I've had a number of bone scans. As far as I know right now, it's still just osteopenia.
Yep. And so what that means is that your bones are a little bit thinner than normal, and there's actually a DEXA, dual energy X-ray absorptiometry test, complicated way of saying you sit on a little table for 5 minutes, and it sort of takes a look at how dense or not dense your bones are and then compares it to a normal population. So if you look at Atelvia, which is interesting, the challenge with that I see is looking at resedronate, which is what it is. You're in the same family.
I know, but they keep saying, "Oh, this works differently. This is coded. This will not produce that." And I am very skeptical.
Well, I would say it may be less likely, but you've still got an oral bisphosphonate there, and bisphosphonates in general can cause reflux. So what are the other choices, you may ask? So the other choice you can look at, and the question I would ask your doctor is, well, what if we changed because those are actually acting on osteoclasts, which are the cells that break down bone. So if you look at teriparatide or Forteo, that works in a different way. And the newest one is actually called Prolia or denosumab that works, again, in a different way. And that's actually a rankle effect. And so if you ask about those two things, Forteo or Prolia, that way you would avoid the bisphosphonate family altogether and ask them what they think about that. That might be an interesting way to go.
Okay, but last question is, what do you think of Evista?
Well, looking at raloxifene, same thing. So if you look at that, that's a SERM. That's a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And it's interesting in that in some cases can be a pharmacologically elegant medicine in that actually has some benefits in breast cancer and actually preventing that. So interesting choice.
Okay, thank you.
All You're right, welcome.
Thank you. Well, we'll try to do one more.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. We'll go again here to Sullivan, line two. Hello.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My mom has a condition that's marked by jerking and twitching of the muscles in her back. It's called myoclonus.
Okay.
And she has been told that all she can do for it is to take sedatives and anticonvulsants. But so far, the ones they've had her try have caused more twitching. That's actually one of the side effects, which seems kind of contradictory. So I wonder if you could advise me how I could research and determine what might be a sedative and an anticonvulsant that have relatively minor side effects.
So the challenge with this is that's an interesting situation in a couple senses. The National Institute of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke, www.ninds.nih.gov, and then put in myoclonus. The challenge with myoclonus is that usually that's it's a brief and sort of involuntary twitching of a muscle or a group of muscle, and it technically, in a neurologic sense, and obviously as a pharmacist, it's interesting. I've just happened to seen a couple of these things in the context of protocol-driven systems, but the interesting thing in that is, it, in my understanding, it typically is a medical sign, and usually isn't thought of as a diagnosis. The other place I would go to is MayoClinic.com. Just mush Mayo Clinic all together, and they've got a pretty good overview of involuntary muscle jerks, and that could actually help you. There's also a treatment focus as well that's balanced and objective. I would go take a look there and then look at what you've tried and then just look at the medicines itself and the possible side effects and then bring that up to your doctor. Complicated one, though. Boy.
Yeah, that's really helpful. She's unable to sleep at night, Jay.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry for that. Yeah.
It's really bad. It's really quite severe. So she's seen a neurologist, and I guess they're going to try to prescribe her some more medication, but she's really concerned about what she takes.
Well, but and that's a good thing, but, you know, at the same time, the challenge with seizure medicines is exactly that. It's the benefit to risk and, you know, what happens and what do you do with that, but that really needs to be tailored to her, and I think I can't give you a really good question over the answer over the phone.
And we are going to have to stop. My apologies.
Oh my,
we have somebody we can't take, but I'm sure somewhere down the road here, Jim will be back with us. In the meantime, if you're interested in information about prescription medicines, one place you can check is his website, which is theessentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. You might also look at the newest incarnation of his book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 12 Top Meds for 2012. You can get that on as a Kindle thing, so if you want to read electronically, or you can get it as a paper book. That's a couple of places you can go to get information. And, Jim, I just want to say, again, thanks very much for giving us your time.
Always an adventure, and, boy, thanks to all the callers. Complicated questions. Always be an advocate for your health care, because medicines matter.
All right.